This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Nickel and Dimed on Not Getting High in America by Barbara Aronike, narrated by Christine McMurdo Wallace, and directed by Mark Pacitti. This book is copyrighted 2001 by Barbara Aronike. This recording is copyrighted 2004 by Recorded Books. Millions of Americans work full-time, year-round, for poverty-level wages. Barbara Aronike decided to join them, inspired in part by the rhetoric surrounding welfare reform, which promised that any job equals a better life. But how can anyone survive, let alone prosper, on $6 to $7 an hour? And now, Nickel and Dimed.
Introduction. Getting ready. The idea that led to this book arose in comparatively sumptuous circumstances. Lewis Lapham, the editor of Harper's, had taken me out for a $30 lunch at some understated French country-style place to discuss future articles I might write for his magazine. I had the salmon and field greens, I think, and was pitching him some ideas having to do with pop culture when the conversation drifted to one of my more familiar themes, poverty. How does anyone live on the wages available to the unskilled? How, in particular, we wondered, were the roughly 4 million women about to be booted into the labor market by welfare reform going to make it on $6 or $7 an hour? Then I said something that I have since had many opportunities to regret. Someone ought to do the old-fashioned kind of journalism. You know, go out there and try it for themselves. I meant someone much younger than myself, some hungry neophyte journalist with time on her hands. But Lapham got this crazy-looking half-smile on his face and ended life as I knew it, for long stretches at least, with the single word, you. The last time anyone had urged me to forsake my normal life for a run-of-the-mill, low-paid job had been in the 70s, when dozens, perhaps hundreds, of 60s radicals started going into the factories to proletarianize themselves and organize the working class in the process. Not this girl. I felt sorry for the parents who had paid college tuition for these blue-collar wannabes, and sorry, too, for the people they intended to uplift. In my own family, the low-wage way of life had never been many degrees of separation away. It was close enough, in any case, to make me treasure the gloriously autonomous, if not always well-paid, writing life. My sister has been through one low-paid job after another— phone company business rep, factory worker, receptionist, constantly struggling against what she calls the hopelessness of being a wage slave. My husband and companion of 17 years was a $4.50 an hour warehouse worker when I fell in with him, escaping eventually and with huge relief to become an organizer for the Teamsters. My father had been a copper miner. Uncles and grandfathers worked in the mines or for the Union Pacific. So to me, sitting at a desk all day was not only a privilege, but a duty. Something I owed to all those people in my life, living and dead, who'd had so much more to say than anyone ever got to hear. Adding to my misgivings, certain family members kept reminding me unhelpfully that I could do this project, after a fashion, without ever leaving my study. I could just pay myself a typical entry-level wage for 8 hours a day, charge myself for room and board plus some plausible expenses like gas, and total up the numbers after a month. With the prevailing wages running at $6 to $7 an hour in my town, and rents at $400 a month or more, the numbers might, it seemed to me, just barely work out all right. But if the question was whether a single mother leaving welfare could survive without government assistance in the form of food stamps, Medicaid, and housing and child care subsidies, The answer was well known before I ever left the comforts of home. According to the National Coalition for the Homeless, in 1998, the year I started this project, it took, on average, nationwide, an hourly wage of $8.89 to afford a one-bedroom apartment. And the Preamble Center for Public Policy was estimating that the odds against a typical welfare recipient's landing a job at such a living wage were about 97 to 1. Why should I bother to confirm these unpleasant facts? As the time when I could no longer avoid the assignment approached, I began to feel a little like the elderly man I once knew who used a calculator to balance his checkbook and then went back and checked the results by redoing each sum by hand. In the end, the only way to overcome my hesitation was by thinking of myself as a scientist, which is, in fact, what I was educated to be. I have a PhD in biology, and I didn't get it by sitting at a desk and fiddling with numbers. In that line of business, you can think all you want, but sooner or later you have to get to the bench and plunge into the everyday chaos of nature, where surprises lurk in the most mundane measurements. Maybe when I got into the project, I would discover some hidden economies in the world of the low-wage worker. After all, if almost 30% of the workforce toils for $8 an hour or less, as the Washington-based Economic Policy Institute reported in 1998, they may have found some tricks as yet unknown to me. Maybe I would even be able to detect in myself the bracing psychological effects of getting out of the house, as promised by the wonks who brought us welfare reform. Or, on the other hand, maybe there would be unexpected costs, physical, financial, emotional, to throw off all my calculations. The only way to find out was to get out there and get my hands dirty. In the spirit of science, I first decided on certain rules and parameters. Rule one, obviously enough, was that I could not, in my search for jobs, fall back on any skills derived from my education or usual work. Not that there were a lot of want ads for essayists anyway. Two, I had to take the highest paying job that was offered me and do my best to hold it. No Marxist rants or sneaking off to read novels in the ladies' room. Three, I had to take the cheapest accommodations I could find, at least the cheapest that offered an acceptable level of safety and privacy, though my standards in this regard were hazy and, as it turned out, prone to deterioration over time. I tried to stick to these rules, but in the course of the project, all of them were bent or broken at some time. In Key West, for example, where I began this project in the late spring of 1998, I once promoted myself to an interviewer for a waitressing job by telling her I could greet European tourists with the appropriate bonjour or guten tag. But this was the only case in which I drew on any remnant of my actual education. In Minneapolis, my final destination, where I lived in the early summer of 2000, I broke another rule by failing to take the best-paying job that was offered, and you'll have to judge my reasons for doing so yourself. And finally, toward the very end, I did break down and rant, stealthily, though, and never within hearing of management. There was also the problem of how to present myself to potential employers, and in particular, how to explain my dismal lack of relevant job experience. The truth, or at least a drastically stripped-down version thereof, seemed easiest. I described myself to interviewers as a divorced homemaker re-entering the workforce after many years, which is true as far as it goes. Sometimes, though not always, I would throw in a few house-cleaning jobs, citing as references former housemates and a friend in Key West whom I have at least helped with after-dinner cleanups now and then. Job application forms also want to know about education, and here I figured the PhD would be no help at all. Might even lead employers to suspect that I was an alcoholic washout or worse. so I confined myself to 3 years of college, listing my real-life alma mater. No one ever questioned my background, as it turned out, and only one employer out of several dozen bothered to check my references. When, on one occasion, an exceptionally chatty interviewer asked about hobbies, I said, writing, and she seemed to find nothing strange about this, although the job she was offering could have been performed perfectly well by an illiterate. Finally, I set some reassuring limits to whatever tribulations I might have to endure. First, I would always have a car. In Key West, I drove my own. In other cities, I used Rent-A-Rex, which I paid for with a credit card rather than my earnings. Yes, I could have walked more, or limited myself to jobs accessible by public transportation. I just figured that a story about waiting for buses wouldn't be very interesting to read. Second, I ruled out homelessness as an option. The idea was to spend a month in each setting and see whether I could find a job and earn, in that time, the money to pay a second month's rent. If I was paying rent by the week and ran out of money, I would simply declare the project at an end. No shelters or sleeping in cars for me. Furthermore, I had no intention of going hungry. If things ever got to the point where the next meal was in question, I promised myself, as the time to begin the experiment approached, I would dig out my ATM card and cheat. So, this isn't the story of some death-defying undercover adventure. Almost anyone could do what I did. Look for jobs, work those jobs, try to make ends meet. In fact, millions of Americans do it every day, and with a lot less fanfare and dithering. I am, of course, very different from the people who normally fill America's least attractive jobs, and in ways that both helped and limited me. Most obviously, I was only visiting a world that others inhabit full-time, often for most of their lives. With all the real-life assets I've built up in middle age, bank account, IRA, health insurance, multi-room home, waiting indulgently in the background, there was no way I was going to experience poverty or find out how it really feels to be a long-term low-wage worker. My aim here was much more straightforward and objective, just to see whether I could match income to expenses, as the truly poor attempt to do every day. Besides, I've had enough unchosen encounters with poverty in my lifetime to know it's not a place you would want to visit for touristic purposes. It just smells too much like fear. Unlike many low-wage workers, I have the further advantage of being white and a native English speaker. I don't think this affected my chances of getting a job, given the willingness of employers to hire almost anyone in the tight labor market of 1998 to 2000. But it almost certainly affected the kinds of jobs I was offered. In Key West, I originally sought what I assumed would be a relatively easy job in hotel housekeeping, and found myself steered instead into waitressing, no doubt because of my ethnicity and my English skills. As it happened, waitressing didn't provide much of a financial advantage over housekeeping, at least not in the low-tip off-season when I worked in Key West. But the experience did help determine my choice of other localities in which to live and work. I ruled out places like New York and L.A., for example, where the working class consists mainly of people of color, and a white woman with unaccented English seeking entry-level jobs might only look desperate or weird. I had other advantages. The car, for example, that set me off from many, though hardly all, of my co-workers. Ideally, at least if I were seeking to replicate the experience of a woman entering the workforce from welfare, I would have had a couple of children in tow. But mine are grown, and no one was willing to lend me theirs for a month-long vacation in penury. In addition to being mobile and unencumbered, I am probably in a lot better health than most members of the long-term low-wage workforce. I had everything going for me. If there were other, subtler things different about me, no one ever pointed them out. Certainly, I made no effort to play a role or fit into some imaginative stereotype of low-wage working women. I wore my usual clothes, wherever ordinary clothes were permitted, and my usual hairstyle and makeup. In conversations with co-workers, I talked about my real children, marital status, and relationships. There was no reason to invent a whole new life. I did modify my vocabulary, however, in one respect. At least when I was new at a job and worried about seeming brash or disrespectful, I censored the profanities that are, thanks largely to the Teamster influence, part of my normal speech. Other than that, I joked and teased, offered opinions, speculations, and, incidentally, a great deal of health-related advice, exactly as I would do in any other setting. Several times since completing this project, I've been asked by acquaintances whether the people I worked with couldn't, tell. The supposition being that an educated person is ineradicably different and in a superior direction from your workaday drones. I wish I could say that some supervisor or co-worker told me even once that I was special in some enviable way. More intelligent, for example, or clearly better educated than most. But this never happened. I suspect because the only thing that really made me special was my inexperience. To state the proposition in reverse, low-wage workers are no more homogeneous in personality or ability than people who write for a living, and no less likely to be funny or bright. Anyone in the educated classes who thinks otherwise ought to broaden their circle of friends. There was always, of course, the difference that only I knew, that I wasn't working for the money. I was doing research for an article, and later a book. I went home every day not to anything resembling a normal domestic life, but to a laptop, on which I spent an hour or two recording the day's events. Very diligently, I should add, since note-taking was seldom an option during the day. This deception, symbolized by the laptop that provided a link to my past and future, bothered me, at least in the case of people I cared about and wanted to know better. I should mention here that names and identifying details have been altered to preserve the privacy of the people I worked with and encountered in other settings during the course of my research. In most cases, I've also changed the names of the places I worked and their exact locations to further ensure the anonymity of people I met. In each setting, toward the end of my stay, and after much anxious forethought, I came out to a few chosen co-workers. The result was always stunningly anticlimactic. My favorite response being, "Does this mean you're not going to be back on the evening shift next week?" I've wondered a lot about why there wasn't more astonishment, or even indignation. And part of the answer probably lies in people's notion of writing. Years ago, when I married my second husband, he proudly told his uncle, who was a valet parker at the time, that I was a writer. The uncle's response? "Who isn't?" Everyone literate writes. And some of the low-wage workers I've known or met through this project write journals and poems, even, in one case, a lengthy science fiction novel. But as I realized very late in this project, it may also be that I was exaggerating the extent of the deception to myself. There's no way, for example, to pretend to be a waitress. The food either gets to the table or not. People knew me as a waitress, a cleaning person, a nursing home aide, or a retail clerk, not because I acted like one, but because that's what I was, at least for the time I was with them. In every job, in every place I lived, the work absorbed all my energy and much of my intellect. I wasn't kidding around. Even though I suspected from the start that the mathematics of wages and rents were working against me, I made a mighty effort to succeed. I make no claims for the relevance of my experiences to anyone else's, because there's nothing typical about my story. Just bear in mind, when I stumble, that this is, in fact, the best-case scenario. A person with every advantage that ethnicity and education, health and motivation can confer, attempting, in a time of exuberant prosperity, to survive in the economy's lower depths. 1. Serving in Florida. Mostly out of laziness, I decide to start my low-wage life in the town nearest to where I actually live, Key West, Florida, which, with a population of about 25,000, is elbowing its way up to the status of a genuine city. The downside of familiarity, I soon realize, is that it's not easy to go from being a consumer, thoughtlessly throwing money around in exchange for groceries and movies and gas, to being a worker in the very same place. I am terrified, especially at the beginning, of being recognized by some friendly business owner or erstwhile neighbor, and having to stammer out some explanation of my project. Happily, though, my fear turns out to be entirely unwarranted. During a month of poverty and toil, no one recognizes my face or my name, which goes unnoticed and, for the most part, unuttered. In this parallel universe where my father never got out of the mines and I never got through college, I am baby, honey, blondie, and, most commonly, girl. My first task is to find a place to live. I figured that if I can earn $7 an hour, which from the want ads seems doable, I can afford to spend $500 on rent, or maybe, with severe economies, $600, and still have $400 or $500 left over for food and gas. In the Key West area, this pretty much confines me to flop houses and trailer homes, like the one, a pleasing 15-minute drive from town, that has no air conditioning, no screens, no fans, no television, and, by way of diversion, only the challenge of evading the landlord's Doberman pincher. The big problem with this place, though, is the rent, which, at $675 a month, is well beyond my reach. All right, Key West is expensive. But so is New York City, or the Bay Area, or Jackson, Wyoming, or Telluride, or Boston, or any other place where tourists and the wealthy compete for living space with the people who clean their toilets and fry their hash browns. Still, it's a shock to realize that trailer trash has become, for me, a demographic category to aspire to. So I decide to make the common trade-off between affordability and convenience and go for a $500 a month efficiency, 30 miles up a two-lane highway from the employment opportunities of Key West, meaning 45 minutes if there's no road construction and I don't get caught behind some sun-dazed Canadian tourists. I hate the drive, along a roadside studded with white crosses commemorating the more effective head-on collisions. But it's a sweet little place, a cabin, more or less, set in the swampy backyard of the converted mobile home where my landlord, an affable TV repairman, lives with his bartender girlfriend. Anthropologically speaking, the trailer park would be preferable. But here I have a gleaming white floor and a firm mattress, and the few resident bugs are easily vanquished. The next piece of business is to comb through the want ads and find a job. I rule out various occupations for one reason or another. Hotel front desk clerk, for example, which, to my surprise, is regarded as unskilled and pays only $6 or $7 an hour, gets eliminated because it involves standing in one spot for 8 hours a day. Waitressing is also something I'd like to avoid, because I remember it leaving me bone-tired when I was 18, and I'm decades of varicosities and back pain beyond that now. Telemarketing, one of the first refuges of the suddenly indigent, can be dismissed on grounds of personality. This leaves certain supermarket jobs, such as deli clerk, or housekeeping in the hotels and guest houses, which pays about $7, and I imagine is not too different from what I've been doing part-time in my own home all my life. So I put on what I take to be a respectable-looking outfit of ironed Bermuda shorts and scooped-necked T-shirt, and set out for a tour of the local hotels and supermarkets. Best Western, Econo Lodge, and Hojo's all let me fill out application forms, and these are, to my relief, mostly interested in whether I'm a legal resident of the United States and have committed any felonies. My next stop is Winn-Dixie, the supermarket, which turns out to have a particularly onerous application process, featuring a 20-minute interview by computer, since, apparently, no human on the premises is deemed capable of representing the corporate point of view. I'm conducted to a large room decorated with posters illustrating how to look professional. It helps to be white and, if female, permed. And warning of the slick promises that union organizers might try to tempt me with. The interview is multiple choice. Do I have anything, such as child care problems, that might make it hard for me to get to work on time? Do I think safety on the job is the responsibility of management? Then, popping up cunningly out of the blue, how many dollars worth of stolen goods have I purchased in the last year? Would I turn in a fellow employee if I caught him stealing? Finally, are you an honest person? Apparently, I ace the interview, because I'm told that all I have to do is show up in some doctor's office tomorrow for a urine test. This seems to be a fairly general rule. If you want to stack Cheerios boxes or vacuum hotel rooms in chemically fascist America, you have to be willing to squat down and pee in front of a health worker, who has no doubt had to do the same thing herself. The wages Winn-Dixie is offering, $6 and a couple of dimes to start with, are not enough, I decide, to compensate for this indignity. 81% of large employers now require pre-employment drug testing, up from 21% in 1987. Among all employers, the rate of testing is highest in the South. The drug most likely to be detected, marijuana, which can be detected weeks after use, is also the most innocuous, while heroin and cocaine are generally undetectable 3 days after use. Alcohol, which clears the body within hours after ingestion, is not tested for. I lunch at Wendy's, where $4.99 gets you unlimited refills at the Mexican part of the superbar, a comforting surfeit of refried beans and cheese sauce. A teenage employee, seeing me study the want ads, kindly offers me an application form, which I fill out, though here, too, the pay is just $6 and change an hour. Then it's off for a round of the locally owned inns and guest houses in Key West's Old Town, which is where all the serious sightseeing and guzzling goes on, a couple of miles removed from the functional end of the island, where the discount hotels make their homes. At the Palms, let's call it, a bouncy manager actually takes me around to see the rooms and meet the current housekeepers, who, I note with satisfaction, look pretty much like me. Faded ex-hippie types in shorts, with long hair pulled back in braids. Mostly, though, no one speaks to me, or even looks at me, except to proffer an application form. At my last stop, a palatial B&B, I wait 20 minutes to meet Max, only to be told that there are no jobs now, but there should be one soon, since nobody lasts more than a couple of weeks. 3 days go by like this, and, to my chagrin, no one from the approximately 20 places at which I've applied calls me for an interview. I had been vain enough to worry about coming across as too educated for the jobs I sought. But no one even seems interested in finding out how overqualified I am. Only later will I realize that the want ads are not a reliable measure of the actual jobs available at any particular time. They are, as I should have guessed from Max's comment, the employer's insurance policy against the relentless turnover of the low-wage workforce. Most of the big hotels run ads almost continually, if only to build a supply of applicants to replace the current workers as they drift away or are fired. So finding a job is just a matter of being in the right place at the right time, and flexible enough to take whatever's being offered that day. This finally happens to me at one of the big discount chain hotels where I go, as usual, for housekeeping, and am sent instead to try out as a waitress at the attached family restaurant, a dismal spot looking out on a parking garage, which is featuring Polish sausage and barbecue sauce on this 95-degree day. Philip, the dapper young West Indian who introduces himself as the manager, interviews me with about as much enthusiasm as if he were a clerk processing me for Medicare, the principal questions being what shifts I can work and when I can start. I mutter about being woefully out of practice as a waitress, but he's already on to the uniform. I'm to show up tomorrow wearing black slacks and black shoes. He'll provide the rust-colored polo shirt with Hearthside, as we'll call the place, embroidered on it. Though I might want to wear my own shirt to get to work, ha-ha. At the word tomorrow, something between fear and indignation rises in my chest. I want to say, thank you for your time, sir, but this is just an experiment, you know, not my actual life. So begins my career at the Hearthside, where for 2 weeks I work from 2 till 10 p.m. for $2.43 an hour plus tips. According to the Fair Labor Standards Act, employers are not required to pay tipped employees, such as restaurant servers, more than $2.13 an hour in direct wages. However, if the sum of tips plus $2.13 an hour falls below the minimum wage, or $5.15 an hour, the employer is required to make up the difference. This fact was not mentioned by managers or otherwise publicized at either of the restaurants where I worked. Employees are barred from using the front door, so I enter the first day through the kitchen, where a red-faced man with shoulder-length blonde hair is throwing frozen steaks against the wall and yelling, "Fuck this shit!" "That's just Billy," explains Gail, the wiry middle-aged waitress who's assigned to train me. "He's on the rag again." A condition occasioned, in this instance, by the fact that the cook on the morning shift had forgotten to thaw out the steaks. For the next 8 hours, I run after the agile Gale, absorbing bits of instruction along with fragments of personal tragedy. All food must be trayed, and the reason she's so tired today is that she woke up in a cold sweat thinking of her boyfriend, who was killed a few months ago in a scuffle in an upstate prison. No refills on lemonade. And the reason he was in prison is that a few DUIs caught up with him, that's all. Could have happened to anyone. Carry the creamers to the table in a monkey bowl, never in your hand. And after he was gone, she spent several months living in her truck, peeing in a plastic pee bottle and reading by candlelight at night. But you can't live in a truck in the summer, since you need to have the windows down, which means anything can get in, from mosquitoes on up. At least Gail puts to rest any fears I had of appearing overqualified. From the first day on, I find that of all the things that I have left behind, such as home and identity, what I miss the most is competence. Not that I have ever felt 100% competent in the writing business, where one day's success augurs nothing at all for the next. But in my writing life, I at least have some notion of procedure. Do the research, make the outline, rough out a draft, etc. As a server, though, I am beset by requests as if by bees. More iced tea here, Ketchup, over there. A to-go box for table 14. And where are the high chairs, anyway? Of the 27 tables, up to 6 are usually mine at any time, though on slow afternoons, or if Gale is off, I sometimes have the whole place to myself. There's the touchscreen computer ordering system to master, which I suppose is meant to minimize server-cook contacts, but in practice requires constant verbal fine-tuning. That's gravy on the mashed, okay? Not on the meatloaf. And so forth. Plus, something I had forgotten in the years since I was 18, about a third of a server's job is side work, invisible to customers. Sweeping, scrubbing, slicing, refilling, and restocking. If it isn't all done, every little bit of it, you're going to face the 6 o'clock p.m. dinner rush defenseless and probably go down in flames. I screw up dozens of times at the beginning, sustained in my shame entirely by Gail's support. It's okay, baby. Everyone does that sometime. Because to my total surprise, and despite the scientific detachment I'm doing my best to maintain, I care. The whole thing would be a lot easier if I could just skate through it like Lily Tomlin in one of her waitress skits. But I was raised by the absurd Booker T. Washingtonian precept that says, if you're going to do something, do it well. In fact, well isn't good enough by half. Do it better than anyone has ever done it before. Or, so said my father, who must have known what he was talking about, because he managed to pull himself and us with him up from the mile-deep copper mines of Butte to the leafy suburbs of the Northeast, ascending from boilermakers to martinis before booze beat out ambition. As in most endeavors I have encountered in my life, doing it better than anyone is not a reasonable goal. Still, when I wake up at 4 a.m. in my own cold sweat, I'm not thinking about the writing deadlines I'm neglecting. I'm thinking of the table where I screwed up the order, and one of the kids didn't get his kiddie meal until the rest of the family had moved on to their key lime pies. That's the other powerful motivation, the customers, or patients, as I can't help thinking of them, on account of the mysterious vulnerability that seems to have left them temporarily unable to feed themselves. After a few days at Hearthside, I feel the service ethic kick in like a shot of oxytocin, the nurturance hormone. The plurality of my customers are hard-working locals, truck drivers, construction workers, even housekeepers from the attached hotel. And I want them to have the closest to a fine dining experience that the grubby circumstances will allow. No, you guys for me. Everyone over 12 is sir or ma'am. I ply them with iced tea and coffee refills. I return mid-meal to inquire how everything is. I doll up their salads with chopped raw mushrooms, summer squash slices, or whatever bits of produce I can find that have survived their sojourn in the cold storage room mold-free. There's Benny, for example, a short, tight-muscled sewer repairman who cannot even think of eating until he's absorbed a half hour of air conditioning and ice water. We chat about hypothermia and electrolytes until he's ready to order some finicky combination like soup of the day, garden salad, and a side of grits. There are the German tourists who are so touched by my pigeon, Willkommen, and Ist alles gut? That they actually tip. Europeans, no doubt spoiled by their trade union-ridden high-wage welfare states, generally don't know that they're supposed to tip. Some restaurants, the Hearthside included, allow servers to grat their foreign customers or add a tip to the bill. Since this amount is added before the customers have a chance to tip or not tip, the practice amounts to an automatic penalty for imperfect English. There are the two dirt-smudged lesbians, just off from their shift, who were impressed enough by my suave handling of the fly in the piña colada that they take the time to praise me to Stu, the assistant manager. There's Sam, the kindly retired cop who has to plug up his tracheotomy hole with one finger in order to force the cigarette smoke into his lungs. Sometimes I play with the fantasy that I am a princess who, in penance for some tiny transgression, has undertaken to feed each of her subjects by hand. But the non-princesses working with me are just as indulgent, even when this means flouting management rules. As to, for example, the number of croutons that can go on to a salad. 6. Put on all you want, Gail whispers, as long as Stu isn't looking. She dips into her own tip money to buy biscuits and gravy for an out-of-work mechanic who's used up all his money on dental surgery, inspiring me to pick up the tab for his pie and milk. Maybe the same high levels of agape can be found throughout the hospitality industry. I remember the poster decorating one of the apartments I looked at, which said, "If you seek happiness for yourself, you will never find it. Only when you seek happiness for others will it come to you." Or words to that effect. An odd sentiment, it seemed to me at the time, to find in the dank one-room basement apartment of a bellhop at the Best Western. At Hearthside, we utilize whatever bits of autonomy we have to ply our customers with the illicit calories that signal our love. It's our job as servers to assemble the salads and desserts, pour the dressings, and squirt the whipped cream. We also control the number of butter pats our customers get, and the amount of sour cream on their baked potatoes. So if you wonder why Americans are so obese, consider the fact that waitresses both express their humanity and earn their tips through the covert distribution of fats. 10 days into it, this is beginning to look like a livable lifestyle. I like Gail, who is looking at 50, age-wise, but moves so fast she can alight in one place and then another, without apparently being anywhere in between. I clown around with Lionel, the teenage Haitian busboy, though we don't have much vocabulary in common, and loiter near the main sink to listen to the older Haitian dishwasher's musical creole, which sounds, in their rich bass voices, like French on testosterone. I bond with Timmy, the 14-year-old white kid who busses at night, by telling him I don't like people putting their baby seats right on the tables. It makes the baby look too much like a side dish. He snickers delightedly, and in return, on a slow night, starts telling me the plots of all the Jaws movies, which are perennial favorites in the shark-ridden Keys. She looks around, and the water skier isn't there anymore. Then, snap, the whole boat goes. I especially like Joan, the svelte 40-ish hostess, who turns out to be a militant feminist, pulling me aside one day to explain that men run everything. We don't have a chance unless we stick together. Accordingly, she backs me up when I get overpowered on the floor, and in return I give her a chunk of my tips, or stand guard while she sneaks off for an unauthorized cigarette break. We all admire her for standing up to Billy and telling him, after some of his usual nastiness about the female server class, to shut the fuck up. I even warm up to Billy when, on a slow night, and to make up for a particularly unwarranted attack on my abilities, or so I imagine, he tells me about his glory days as a young man at Coronary School in Brooklyn, where he dated a knockout Puerto Rican chick. Or do you say culinary? I finish up every night at 10 or 10:30, depending on how much side work I've been able to get done during the shift, and cruise home to the tapes I snatched at random when I left my real home. Marianne Faithful, Tracy Chapman, Enigma, King Sunny Ade, Violent Femmes, just drained enough for the music to set my cranium resonating, but hardly dead. Midnight snack is Wheat Thins and Monterey Jack, accompanied by cheap white wine on ice and whatever AMC has to offer. To bed by 1:30 or 2, up at 9 or 10, read for an hour while my uniform whirls around in the landlord's washing machine, and then it's another 8 hours spent following Mao's central instruction, as laid out in the little red book, which was, "Serve the people." I could drift along like this, in some dreamy proletarian idyll, except for two things. One is management. If I've kept this subject to the margins so far, it's because I still flinch to think that I spent all those weeks under the surveillance of men and later women, whose job it was to monitor my behavior for signs of sloth, theft, drug abuse, or worse. Not that managers, and especially assistant managers in low-wage settings like this, are exactly the class enemy. Mostly, in the restaurant business, they're former cooks still capable of pinch-hitting in the kitchen. Just as in hotels, they're likely to be former clerks, and paid a salary of only about $400 a week. But everyone knows they've crossed over to the other side, which is, crudely put, corporate, as opposed to human. Cooks want to prepare tasty meals. Servers want to serve them graciously. But managers are there for only one reason: to make sure that money is made for some theoretical entity, the corporation, which exists far away in Chicago or New York, if a corporation can be said to have a physical existence at all. Reflecting on her career, Gail tells me ruefully that she swore, years ago, never to work for a corporation again. They don't cut you no slack. You give, and you give, and they take. Managers can sit, for hours at a time if they want, but it's their job to see that no one else ever does, even when there's nothing to do. And this is why, for servers, slow times can be as exhausting as rushes. You start dragging out each little chore, because if the manager on duty catches you in an idle moment, he'll give you something far nastier to do. So I wipe, I clean, I consolidate ketchup bottles and recheck the cheesecake supply, even tour the tables to make sure the customer evaluation forms are all standing perkily in their places. Wondering all the time how many calories I burn in these strictly theatrical exercises. In desperation, I even take the desserts out of their glass display case and freshen them up with whipped cream and bright new maraschino cherries. Anything to look busy. When, on a particularly dead afternoon, Stu finds me glancing at a USA Today a customer has left behind, he assigns me to vacuum the entire floor with the broken vacuum cleaner, which has a handle only 2 feet long. And the only way to do that without incurring orthopedic damage is to proceed from spot to spot on your knees. On my first Friday at Hearthside, there's a mandatory meeting for all restaurant employees, which I attend, eager for insight into our overall marketing strategy and the niche. Your basic Ohio cuisine with a tropical twist? We aim to inhabit. But there is no we at this meeting. Philip, our top manager except for an occasional consultant sent out by corporate headquarters, opens it with a sneer. The break room. It's disgusting. Butts in the ashtrays, newspapers lying around, crumbs. This windowless little room, which also houses the time clock for the entire hotel, is where we stash our bags and civilian clothes and take our half-hour meal breaks. But a break room is not a right, he tells us. It can be taken away. We should also know that the lockers in the break room, and whatever is in them, can be searched at any time. Then comes gossip. There has been gossip. Gossip, which seems to mean employees talking among themselves, must stop. Off-duty employees are henceforth barred from eating at the restaurant because other servers gather around them and gossip. When Philip has exhausted his agenda of rebukes, Joan complains about the condition of the ladies' room, and I throw in my two bits about the vacuum cleaner. But I don't see any backup coming from my fellow servers, each of whom has slipped into her own personal funk. Gail, my role model, stares sorrowfully at a point 6 inches from her nose. The meeting ends when Andy, one of the cooks, gets up muttering about breaking up his day off for this almighty bullshit. Just 4 days later, we're suddenly summoned into the kitchen at 3:30 p.m., even though there are live tables on the floor. We all, about 10 of us, stand around Philip, who announces grimly that there has been a report of some drug activity on the night shift, and that, as a result, we are now to be a drug-free workplace, meaning that all new hires will be tested, and possibly also current employees on a random basis. I'm glad that this part of the kitchen is so dark, because I find myself blushing as hard as if I had been caught toking up in the ladies' room myself. I haven't been treated this way, lined up in the corridor, threatened with locker searches, peppered with carelessly aimed accusations, since at least junior high school. Back on the floor, Joan cracks. Next, they'll be telling us we can't have sex on the job. When I ask Stu what happened to inspire the crackdown, he just mutters about management decisions and takes the opportunity to upbraid Gail and me for being too generous with the roles. From now on, there's to be only one per customer, and it goes out with the dinner, not with the salad. He's also been riding the cooks, prompting Andy to come out of the kitchen and observe, with the serenity of a man whose customary implement is a butcher knife, that Stu has a death wish today. Later in the evening, the gossip crystallizes around the theory that Stu is himself the drug culprit, that he uses the restaurant phone to order up marijuana and sends one of the late servers out to fetch it for him. The server was caught, and she may have ratted out Stu, at least enough to cast some suspicion on him, thus accounting for his pissy behavior. Who knows? Personally, I'm ready to believe anything bad about Stu, who serves no evident function and presumes too much on our common ethnicity, sidling up to me one night to engage in a little nativism directed at the Haitian immigrants. I feel like I'm the foreigner here. They're taking over the country. Still, later that evening, the drug in question escalates to crack. Lionel, the busboy, entertains us for the rest of the shift by standing just behind Stu's back and sucking deliriously on an imaginary joint, or maybe a pipe. The other problem, in addition to the less than nurturing management style, is that this job shows no sign of being financially viable. You might imagine, from a comfortable distance, that people who live year in and year out on $6 to $10 an hour have discovered some survival stratagems unknown to the middle class. But no. It's not hard to get my coworkers talking about their living situations, because housing, in almost every case, is the principal source of disruption in their lives, the first thing they'll fill you in on when they arrive for their shifts. After a week, I've compiled the following survey. Gail is sharing a room in a well-known downtown flophouse for $250 a week. Her roommate, a male friend, has begun hitting on her, driving her nuts. But the rent would be impossible alone. Claude, the Haitian cook, is desperate to get out of the two-room apartment he shares with his girlfriend and two other unrelated people. As far as I can determine, the other Haitian men live in similarly crowded situations. Annette, a 20-year-old server who's 6 months pregnant and abandoned by her boyfriend, lives with her mother, a postal clerk. Marianne, who's a breakfast server and her boyfriend, are paying $170 a week for a one-person trailer. Billy, who at $10 an hour is the wealthiest of us, lives in the trailer he owns, paying only the $400 a month lot fee. The other white cook, Andy, lives on his dry-docked boat, which, as far as I can tell from his loving descriptions, can't be more than 20 feet long. He offers to take me out on it once it's repaired, but the offer comes with inquiries as to my marital status, so I don't follow up on it. Tina, another server, and her husband are paying $60 a night for a room in the Days Inn. This is because they have no car, and the Days Inn is in walking distance of the Hearthside. When Marianne is tossed out of her trailer for subletting, which is against trailer park rules, she leaves her boyfriend and moves in with Tina and her husband. Joan, who had fooled me with her numerous and tasteful outfits, hostesses wear their own clothes, lives in a van parked behind a shopping center at night, and showers in Tina's motel room. The clothes are from thrift shops. I could find no statistics on the number of employed people living in cars or vans. But according to a 1997 report of the National Coalition for the Homeless, nearly one-fifth of all homeless people in 29 cities across the nation are employed in full or part-time jobs. It strikes me, in my middle-class solipsism, that there's gross improvidence in some of these arrangements. When Gail and I are wrapping silverware and napkins, the only task for which we're permitted to sit, she tells me she's thinking of escaping from her roommate by moving into the Days Inn herself. I'm astounded. How can she even think of paying $40 to $60 a day? But if I was afraid of sounding like a social worker, I've come out just sounding like a fool. She squints at me in disbelief. And where am I supposed to get a month's rent and a month's deposit for an apartment? I'd been feeling pretty smug about my $500 efficiency, but of course it was made possible only by the $1,300 I had allotted myself for startup costs when I began my low-wage life. $1,000 for the first month's rent and deposit, $100 for initial groceries and cash in my pocket, $200 stuffed away for emergencies. In poverty, as in certain propositions in physics, starting conditions are everything. There are no secret economies that nourish the poor. On the contrary, there are a host of special costs. If you can't put up the 2 months' rent you need to secure an apartment, you end up paying through the nose for a room by the week. If you have only a room, with a hot plate at best, you can't save by cooking up huge lentil stews that can be frozen for the week ahead. You eat fast food, or the hot dogs and styrofoam cups of soup that can be microwaved in a convenience store. If you have no money for health insurance, and the Hearthside's niggardly plan kicks in only after 3 months, you go without routine care or prescription drugs and end up paying the price. Gail, for example, was doing fine, health-wise anyway, until she ran out of money for estrogen pills. She's supposed to be on the company health plan by now, but they claim to have lost her application form and to be beginning the paperwork all over again. So she spends $9 a pop for pills to control the migraines she wouldn't have, she insists, if her estrogen supplements were covered. Similarly, Marianne's boyfriend lost his job as a roofer because he missed so much time after getting a cut on his foot for which he couldn't afford the prescribed antibiotic. My own situation, when I sit down to assess it after 2 weeks of work, wouldn't be much better if this were my actual life. The seductive thing about waitressing is that you don't have to wait for payday to feel a few bills in your pocket. And my tips usually cover meals and gas, plus something left over to stuff into the kitchen drawer I use as a bank. But as the tourist business slows in the summer heat, I sometimes leave work with only $20 in tips. The gross is higher, but servers share about 15% of their tips with the busboys and bartenders. With wages included, This amounts to about the minimum wage of $5.15 an hour. The sum in the drawer is piling up, but at the present rate of accumulation will be more than $100 short of my rent when the end of the month comes around. Nor can I see any expenses to cut. True, I haven't gone the lentil stew route yet, but that's because I don't have a large cooking pot, pot holders, or a ladle to stir with, which would cost a total of about $30 at Kmart, somewhat less at a thrift store. Not to mention onions, carrots, and the indispensable bay leaf. I do make my lunch almost every day, usually some slow-burning, high-protein combo like frozen chicken patties with melted cheese on top and canned pinto beans on the side. Dinner is at the Hearthside, which offers its employees a choice of BLT, fish sandwich, or hamburger for only $2. The burger lasts longest, especially if it's heaped with gut-puckering jalapenos. But by midnight, my stomach is growling again. So, unless I want to start using my car as a residence, I have to find a second or an alternative job. I call all the hotels I'd filled out housekeeping applications at weeks ago, the Hyatt, Holiday Inn, Econolodge, Hojo's, Best Western, plus a half dozen locally run guest houses. Nothing. Then I start making the rounds again, wasting whole mornings waiting for some assistant manager to show up, even dipping into places so creepy that the front desk clerk greets you from behind bulletproof glass and sells pints of liquor over the counter. But either someone has exposed my real-life housekeeping habits, which are, shall we say, mellow, or I'm at the wrong end of some infallible ethnic equation. Most, but by no means all, of the working housekeepers I see on my job searches are African-Americans, Spanish-speaking, or refugees from the Central European post-communist world, while servers are almost invariably white and monolingually English-speaking. When I finally get a positive response, I have been identified once again as server material. Jerry's, again not the real name, which is part of a well-known national chain and physically attached here to another budget hotel, is ready to use me at once. The prospect is both exciting and terrifying because, with about the same number of tables and counter seats, Jerry's attracts 3 or 4 times the volume of customers at the gloomy old Hearthside. Picture a fat person's hell. And I don't mean a place with no food. Instead, there is everything you might eat if eating had no bodily consequences. The cheese fries, the chicken fried steaks, the fudge-laden desserts. Only here, every bite must be paid for, one way or another, in human discomfort. The kitchen is a cavern, a stomach leading to the lower intestine that is the garbage and dishwashing area, from which issue bizarre smells combining the edible and the awful, creamy carrion, pizza barf, and that unique and enigmatic Jerry's scent, citrus fart. The floor is slick with spills, forcing us to walk through the kitchen with tiny steps, like Susan McDougal in Leg Irons. Sinks everywhere are clogged with scraps of lettuce, decomposing lemon wedges, waterlogged toast crusts. Put your hand down on any counter, and you risk being stuck to it by the film of ancient syrup spills. And this is unfortunate, because hands are utensils here, used for scooping up lettuce onto the salad plates, lifting out pie slices, and even moving hash browns from one plate to another. The regulation poster in the single unisex restroom admonishes to wash our hands thoroughly, and even offers instructions for doing so. But there's always some vital substance missing. Soap, paper towels, toilet paper. And I never found all three at once. You learn to stuff your pockets with napkins before going in there. And too bad about the customers, who must eat, although they don't realize it, almost literally out of our hands. The break room summarizes the whole situation. There is none. Because there are no breaks at Jerry's. For 6 to 8 hours in a row, you never sit except to pee. Actually, There are three folding chairs at a table immediately adjacent to the bathroom. But hardly anyone ever sits in this, the very rectum of the gastroarchitectural system. Rather, the function of the peritoilet area is to house the ashtrays, in which servers and dishwashers leave their cigarettes burning at all times, like votive candles, so they don't have to waste time lighting up again when they dash back here for a puff. Almost everyone smokes, as if their pulmonary well-being depended on it. The multinational melange of cooks, the dishwashers who are all Czechs here, the servers who are American natives, creating an atmosphere in which oxygen is only an occasional pollutant. My first morning at Jerry's, when the hypoglycemic shakes set in, I complained to one of my fellow servers that I don't understand how she can go so long without food. "Well, I don't understand how you can go so long without a cigarette," she responds in a tone of reproach. Because work is what you do for others. Smoking is what you do for yourself. I don't know why the anti-smoking crusaders have never grasped the element of defiant self-nurturance that makes the habit so endearing to its victims. As if, in the American workplace, the only thing people have to call their own is the tumors they're nourishing and the spare moments they devote to feeding them. Now, the Industrial Revolution is not an easy transition, especially, in my experience, when you have to zip through it in just a couple of days. I've gone from craft work straight into the factory, from the air-conditioned morgue of the hearthside directly into the flames. Customers arrive in human waves, sometimes disgorged 50 at a time from their tour buses, peckish and whiny. Instead of two girls on the floor at once, there can be as many as six of us running around in our brilliant pink and orange Hawaiian shirts. Conversations, either with customers or with fellow employees, seldom last more than 20 seconds at a time. On my first day, in fact, I'm hurt by my sister server's coldness. My mentor for the day is a supremely competent, emotionally uninflected 23-year-old, and the others, who gossip a little among themselves about the real reason someone is out sick today and the size of the bail bond someone else has had to pay, ignore me completely. On my second day, I find out why. "Well, it's good to see you again," one of them says in greeting. "Hardly anyone comes back after the first day." I feel powerfully vindicated, a survivor. But it would take a long time, probably months, before I could hope to be accepted into this sorority. I start out with the beautiful, heroic idea of handling two jobs at once. And for 2 days, I almost do it, working the breakfast-lunch shift at Jerry's from 8 till 2, arriving at the hearthside a few minutes late at 2:10, and attempting to hold out until 10 o'clock. In the few minutes I have between jobs, I pick up a spicy chicken sandwich at the Wendy's drive-through window, gobble it down in the car, and change from khaki slacks to black, from Hawaiian to rust-colored polo. There's a problem, though. When, during the 3 to 4 o'clock dead time, I finally sit down to wrap silver, my flesh seems to bond to the seat. I try to refuel with a purloined cup of clam chowder, as I've seen Gail and Joan do dozens of times. But Stu catches me and hisses, "No eating!" Although there's not a customer around to be offended by the sight of food making contact with a server's lips. So I tell Gail I'm going to quit, and she hugs me and says she might just follow me to Jerry's herself. But the chances of this are minuscule. She's left the flop house and her annoying roommate and is back to living in her truck. "But guess what?" she reports to me excitedly later that evening. "Philip has given her permission to park overnight in the hotel parking lot, as long as she keeps out of sight. And the parking lot should be totally safe, since it's patrolled by a hotel security guard." With the hearthside offering benefits like that, how could anyone think of leaving? This must be Philip's theory, anyway. He accepts my resignation with a shrug, his main concern being that I return my two polo shirts and aprons. Gail would have triumphed at Jerry's, I'm sure, But for me, it's a crash course in exhaustion management. Years ago, the kindly fry cook who trained me to waitress at a Los Angeles truck stop used to say, "Never make an unnecessary trip. If you don't have to walk fast, walk slow. If you don't have to walk, stand." But at Jerry's, the effort of distinguishing necessary from unnecessary and urgent from whenever would itself be too much of an energy drain. The only thing to do is treat each shift as a one-time-only emergency.